tonight on Arena. The Life and Times of Paddy Armstrong, a theatrical retelling of the story of one of the wrongly convicted Guildford Four, and live music from ballad singing tour guide Sean Fitzgerald. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six are groupings of victimised innocent people etched into the minds of many Irish people since the days of the Troubles. Rounded up, brutally beaten, condemned to prison, they were used by the British system to answer for the horror felt by the no-warning IRA bombs in Guildford and Woolwich. One of the Guildford Four was Paddy Armstrong, who was only 24 when he was arrested in 1974. He served 15 years in prisons for crimes he was not involved in. In 2017, with the help of Mary Elaine Tynan, Paddy wrote his memoir of that time. Mary Elaine, Niamh Gleeson and actor Don Witcherly have now adapted that memoir for the stage as a one-man show starring Don as Paddy Armstrong. I'm delighted that Mary Elaine Tynan and Don Witcherly are with me in studio this evening. Just before we were coming to air, Mary Elaine, I was asking you about when your interest in the story of Paddy Armstrong started, I guess, from very early on.
It did. My mother's from Belfast, so I was always interested.
As is Paddy.
Yeah, exactly. They wouldn't have grown up too far apart. And I remember seeing In the Name of the Father, you know, as a teenager and being
which
so
which, of course, told the same story, but from the point of view of Gerry Conlon.
Totally different perspective. But I was, I really got it because I spent so much time in Belfast as a child that, you know, I really got it. And then when I started working in a school, the school that I went to, my music teacher ended up marrying Paddy Armstrong, Caroline. And I ended up working there with her. And so years later, I interviewed Paddy and there it began, and I made a documentary about him for Documentary on One here in RTE, and then he asked me to write his memoir, and I said no, because I was terrified, but I agreed to do it, and that came out in 2017.
And the nature of that memoir, which I think will feed in some ways into what yourself and Don and Niamh have done in this theatrical adaptation, how would you describe, because what it sounds like to me is that you sat down with Paddy Armstrong and he basically told the story to you, not in some kind of perfect chronological order, but in the way most of us speak, with bits and pieces coming from here and there.
I mean, the words, a lot of the words in the play would be Paddy's own words. And they would have originally come from when I interviewed him for the memoir. The structure, how we do it, all of that was very much a creative process, initially between myself and Niamh, and then really between myself and Don later on as to how we told that story. But yeah, a lot of, and Don and I made recordings of Paddy, and the words as they fell from his mouth, yeah, we tried to very much realise through the play.
Yeah, Don, you obviously you met Paddy Armstrong along the way here. One of the challenges when you're dealing with somebody who's alive or a real person, whether you're looking at archive footage of them or whatever it is, you have to make that decision about the performance of a character here and the portrayal of a real person. How did you start to address that balance, which I guess is one of the main ones in something like this, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose for an actor it is a bit, you know, he is there. And I used to see him around because he lives in my locale, do you know what I mean? And I used to see him around, never really got introduced to him. So he was a figure of fascination for me because, like Mary Elaine, obviously I would have been around and would have seen, you know, Name of the Father and all that stuff. But he was a lesser known character in that whole thing. Yeah. He was maybe not the orator that maybe Gerry was, but his story, I didn't know as much. And when Mary Elaine started hounding me back in 23.
I think asking you to help work with her on this is a phrase you were searching for there,
yes,
Don.
So she said, I think you were, could I give you a book and could this be a play? Could it be a one-man play? And I remember reading it going, my God, there was so much in it. I mean, there is so much wonderful exposition about his life and his young life as well as the life in prison that he had for those 15 years. So it was, I don't know, revelatory for me. And I read it again. And then we met up for coffee and I was going, where? Always with a one-man show, which is what the way Mary Elaine perceived it to go, I always want to know, why does the guy address the audience? Why does the one man, one woman, whatever, in a one-person show, why do they talk to the audience? And so we kind of, that's where my I started going, why does he? And then somewhere along the line, somewhere between Salinas Lord, it came together. We didn't let it slip away. Having met Paddy, obviously, through Mary Lane, we just came at it and figured out how that because it's probably only a thing for me. Anyone can talk to an audience, but as an actor, I'm thinking, why is he talking to the audience? Yeah. And once I get it that, and once I'm happy that I'm talking,
you can talk to the audience.
Then I'll start acting. You know?
You started the right place to start was back with your mother and that Belfast part of the story. What was that early life like in Belfast for Paddy Armstrong, Mary Lynn?
Paddy had a really lovely life in Belfast. I mean, they didn't have money, but they lived in a small community where everyone knew everyone. Paddy's words, what he would say, I could be in one lad's house eating his dinner and he'd be in my house eating mine. And he was surrounded by sisters. He didn't have any brothers. And, you know, he will admit...
Three sisters, was it, that he had, or were there more in the family?
There were four sisters. He lost a sister at one point. But he would still have three sisters today. And he was very much closeted, and they would dress him up in, you know, actual girls' clothes and like a doll and things like that. And he's a very gentle person. But he loved football as well, and he'd be out in the streets playing. He had a very happy childhood. And then, I mean, because Paddy was born in 1950. So then things started to change in the 60s, and that's when Belfast turned.
Yeah, and if you think of as the 60s drew to a close and the 70s started in, the Troubles were in full swing, and he was at a very impressionable age then at that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, late teens.
And
really.
I think there was a push as well to maybe get a lot of young fellas like him out of the dangers of Belfast.
Yeah. And it was a local priest that we see that in the play.
Yeah, the local, I think, had his own reason for doing
he
that.
Did, yeah, he did.
But at the same time, that was the idea, to push him out, and it'd be safer in London now, ironically.
It wasn't.
As he found out.
So,
Is that a little bit, I see a highlighted piece of the script in front of you, Don. Is that a little bit about the early Belfast life? Is that what it's dealing with or tell me what?
Yeah, that's a little bit of the early. Would you like some?
Yeah, so let's
I always put a script in front of me when I'm doing these things now, even though I know it off by heart. If you come to see the play, I will know the lines. It's just, I did one with Owen Colfer, his one-man show, and in front of a live audience at Edinburgh 1 year. And I said, well, I know it. I'm doing it every night. And something happened. The lights didn't go down. I was looking at the audience. One woman was texting on her phone. I just totally got lost. And now
it was her fault, Don.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I'll put my phone down and I won't text, I promise.
Yeah. Okay. So would you like a bit?
This is him. This is Paddy Armstrong as performed by you, talking a little bit about that Belfast childhood.
His dad and his mom and are all mentioned in this. But so here. I have a wee surprise for your birthday, son. What is it, Daddy? Takes me on the bus down the town for my fifth birthday. Just us boys. The Mikado. Daddy watches the stage and I watch him. He's somewhere else, transported. Music can do that. Not the only thing that can't, mate. Mommy was always singing, filling the big basin in our kitchen. I have often walked down the street before. Oh, Mommy, I only washed the other day. Get in, you, or this water will be stone cold by the time it's Gertie's turn. Hate baths, scrubbed neck, ears, toenails. Mommy never misses an inch. Prefer when she gives us sixpence to go down the swimming pool on the falls. That's what everyone does round here of a Friday. In for a swim, out clean. Well, the body, anyway. And for the soul, of course, of a Friday. Fish. Arguing over who gets to see the one-armed man working down the chippy. It's my turn, Daddy. Eileen went last time. I did not. That was our Harriet, so it was. Daddy hands me the money. Ask for two big fish suppers, son. That should do the seven of us. Eileen's face as I get to deliver Daddy's line. Right. I'm away off to see the fugitive.
That's Don Wycherley as Paddy Armstrong and the entire family. at times they're in the play, The Life and Times of Paddy Armstrong. Don is with me in studio this evening, along with one of the writers of the piece, Mary Elaine Tynan, who had also, as you heard, made a documentary about Paddy Armstrong, who was one of the Guildford Four, and indeed written the memoir with Paddy. You really do get a sense there, Elaine, that it was a beautiful childhood, full of this musical stuff all around him, and he clearly was very sensitive to all of that material. But things changed, I think, a little bit when he got into his teens. He got fond of putting the half crown that he was given from his granny, he'd start gambling it.
Yeah, Paddy loves gambling, and he has all these analogies about gambling, and you know, and his favorite kind of you know, whether it's a Yankee bet or there's another kind of bet that he likes doing. Can't remember which one it is now. He'd be screaming at the radio if he heard. But yeah, he did like gambling. There's no question about it. And that would have formed. But even in prison, Paddy gambled. You know,
yeah.
After prison, Paddy gambled a lot. You know, when he had a bit of money. And that was what you did on the streets of Belfast. That's what you did in the bookies. You know.
And the move to London, there was a girl involved and the priest, and they wanted him away from about the place and over to London he went. How quickly, or what kind of life was he having initially in London, Don, before the knock came at the door, you know?
Yeah, well, from obviously, I think a lot of people have taken the path that Paddy took. It was kind of standing outside on the Cricklewood Road, waiting for the van to pull up. They pick a couple off, you go to the building site.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff that everybody did. He was working, he was paying rent, doing a bit of that, but that was a bit strenuous. So Paddy stopped paying rent and headed to a squat, which was much cheaper.
Quite common as well in the 70s, that type of way of living.
He kind of did little gigs on and off, worked as a lounge boy kind of stuff in a local bar. He was just like most guys, young guys of that age, as long as you had a few quid to go out that night. That's what he was describing. He certainly went out and he liked his music. He loved, still on the wall at home in the room, his Pink Floyd signed album. He loved them. And so it was great joy to bring his love of music out in the play. And it's very much...
There's music interspersed in the play.
Oh, there is. Yeah. And he, you know, he loved Floyd, Zeppelin, all that music of the time. And some of the people that come to the play just love it for the music. They went, oh my God, that brought me straight back, you know.
And so far, we're just talking about a very ordinary teenage years, the typical beginning of the 20s for somebody who maybe emigrated or went to live in London at that time. He was living in this squat. He had a girlfriend there, an English girl, Carol Richardson, who was also convicted. And they were having a bit of a wild weekend.
Yeah, they were certainly dabbling in some things that you couldn't really talk about here. But yeah, as young people do, I suppose. And he was definitely living a life of excess.
Yeah. Excess. And they were off their heads. Yeah. When the police...
Well, that's what I was going to say, Marilyn. I mean, the way you tell it in the play, which is true to life, of course, that they, you know, they were kind of waking up from this very... heavy going weekend.
They were in the middle of
and
the heavy
going
weekend.
And they were being pulled out of the beds at gunpoint by police officers.
Yeah,
they were.
Well, they were really looking for somebody at that stage. And like it, when you get into the depths of what really happened, it just looked like the Surrey police that were desperate to get somebody. These bombings were happening. It was not a good place to be. And once one name was given, they wanted other names, and they just had to give a name. And it seems
Paddy would have told you this story, I suppose. How? Like that particular morning, which is dramatised within the show, Mary Lynn, what was going through his mind? Because you spoke directly to him, but all of their minds in that house at that time.
They hadn't a clue what was going on. They thought it was a mistake. They kept thinking this will be sorted out.
Yeah.
They didn't take it that seriously. I mean, it was where I mean, Jerry was pulled out of a bed. I can't remember where.
Jerry Conlon.
Yeah, Jerry was. But and Carol had wandered off and got arrested in her mum's house. Paddy was actually at the party at night time when he was arrested, and they burst into the party. It was all in the middle of everything that happened, and yeah, he was really off his head. So to him, this was just like a wild trip. And next minute he's in a police station. It took him days to come down.
And there is a lovely detail within all that, because Jerry Conlon has been in and out. They've certainly we meet Jerry Conlon in Belfast.
Yeah, he would have known him from the streets. And he would have known a lot of lads.
And he was so colourful. I think I don't know whether these are your words, Mary Elaine, or not, but they refer to him in the play, or Paddy refers to Jerry Conlon in the play as, oh look, here comes Daniel Day, because Jerry was quite a colourful character.
He was, and I suppose you can play around, and not to give too much away, but we do play with timelines, obviously, you know. Because this is Paddy telling the story today about back then. But Jerry was, it seems, I never had the fortune to meet him, but Paddy was extremely fond of him and always kept in touch with him, and a larger than life character.
And you get the sense of the real fun and crack that was being had, Don. But then the sections of the play that start to deal with, you're jumping between Paddy thinking about his Belfast childhood, Paddy thinking about the fun he was having with the people in the squat and all the rest of it, and the interrogation that was going on. the interrogation is absolutely chilling and frightening.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was wonderful. Alistair Logan, actually, who represented him, and he was asked, would he be his free legal aid at the time? And no one wanted to take on the case to represent a bomber. And it was already almost
done. Well, as they were being called at
yes,
the time.
You know, and, and Alistair Logan was an independent. He said, surely one of the big firms has got a legal, a young guy, a young buck looking to make a name. Nobody wanted to go near it. So they rang him back, and a day later said, will you take it? He said, okay, I'll go in and see. Why is it almost a done deal? But he went in and saw the state of him, and you know, obviously what had he'd been obviously beaten around, and he couldn't understand him initially because he was finding it hard to speak, and he was going, I just. When you hear Alistair Logan tell about the first meeting, he said that he was dishevelled, he was a shriveled up.
Bruises everywhere.
Mm. And he's going, right, okay. He asked to see the confession. They said, we wrote it down. Do you know what I mean? And there's just so many, if he started now, Alistair Logan's questioned, he did a Q&A after the opening night in The Viking, and he said, to this day, you can't access the files of any of that for the next 70 years. So, you know, yeah. But it does cause controversy. I ended up in a row with somebody who says there's no smoke without fire. I don't believe that he wasn't involved.
Well,
I've read everything that it's written.
If somebody is found and a conviction is quashed, the conviction is quashed. Yeah. End of discussion.
There were whispering campaigns among the legal profession afterwards because it was so embarrassing. This was, I mean, such a massive climb down. There were many, many people who had to have lied for this to happen. Mm. So afterwards, they weren't very happy to have to admit what they had done. And so there are people, you know, in certain circles in the UK who would still try to continue that narrative.
But if you look at how the confessions were got at the time, and this is detailed within the play and detailed within the memoir as well, what I think is important within all of this is the nature of that violence and the nature of the brutality and fear that must have been there in 20-year-olds, remember, that's what most of them were at the time. How important was it for you, Mary Elaine, that side, you couldn't kind of run away from it, but you can't over-dramatise it either?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really tricky balance to find because we were conscious that there would be people watching this play who weren't familiar with the story. And what you didn't want them to do was, it was very important that they understood why. There are a certain number of questions that people always ask about the Guildford Four. And one of them is, why did you confess? Why did they confess? So it was very important that they understand that. But at the same time, you know, we didn't need to bash the audience over the head with it too. Mm. So it was about trying to find that balance.
But I guess that's within the performance as well for you, Don, because you're switching. You're the interrogator in one sentence and you're Paddy Armstrong in the next sentence.
Yeah, you're asking the lot of an audience, but hopefully you've been...
No.
They've been able to, you know, because I suppose they're all voices in Paddy's head, and but he remembers them succinctly, and he, like, they're there for him, and he would be able to talk about a certain event as... you know, as clear as if it was yesterday. So you try to bring that across, and some of the guys we spoke of who were the guys that would have been involved in that interrogation, and he still remembers their names, what they smelt like. It's that visceral for him, you know.
And post-interrogation, the life in prison was hardly a holiday camp either, Mary Elaine. The kind of victimisation, they were Category A prisoners, which meant that they could be in solitary confinement for long periods of time.
Yes.
How difficult was that regime in terms of the treatment of other prisoners of Paddy Armstrong and the other members who had been convicted and imprisoned?
I mean, indescribable. I remember when I was writing the memoir, I mean, when I was writing that particular part and Paddy and I were working through it, I was having nightmares because it was horrific. They were the lowest of the low. So in prison terminology, they were lower than the nonces, which are paedophiles. Mm. They were treated worse than anybody else was. And it was the prisoner population, also the screws. You know, everyone treated them like that because these bombings were still happening, and, you know, there were women and children being killed. And so, you know, they were the receptacle of all the anger in the prisons.
Yeah, so there was understandable anger, but the people who were the victims of it, and as you said, the screws of the prison officers, either turning her blind eye or possibly...
Oh, well, they would take, I mean, you know...
I think we actually have a bit. Do you want
to why don't you give us a bit that features that section?
So,
this is, again,
but set it up first, Don. I think, just getting it, that it's very dark, but at the same time, Paddy always seemed to have a bright outlook in terms of... Yeah. And he'd talk about... And he'd be more interested in talking about how they made prison hooch on the landing than... Do you know what I mean? And I'd be going... And he'd be telling an amazing story about getting the apples in. And but anyway, this is the dark side, and we'll give this, even though there's a bit of funny here. So, awake every morning at 6, gripping the thin cell mattress till my fingers bleed. Where was mattress Mike when I needed him? Probably only doing the taxiing back then. Dear Mommy, thanks for your letter. It was lovely to get the news from back home. It's not so bad here. There's lots of Irish lads, and we all look out for each other, so we do. We're treated well, and the food is actually very tasty. Actually, it's a living hell. And even the pedos aren't as hated as the paddies. Found a wee turd in my food yesterday, but usually it's crushed glass or cockroaches.
It is extraordinary when you think of somebody trying to live through that. And as you're playing it there for Don, I can see that it gets to you as much as anything else. But it is that thing that I'll let Don recover a little bit. It is that thing that Paddy Armstrong seems to do, well, certainly within this script. That's facility to turn on a sixpence and say, yeah, I wonder where Mattress Mick was when I needed him. I mean, he clearly had a kind of a sense of humour that somehow got him through all of this.
You know, it's funny because, I mean, I've read a lot about all of the, you know, victims of miscarriage of justice, and they all fare differently and respond differently. Paddy has a pretty good life today. You know, he's had some health challenges, but he is very happy. And he said he made a decision, even when he was in prison, to just try to do his best to survive. Now, he went through some really tough times, but his attitude is extraordinary. And people, including myself before I met him, don't believe sometimes that he's not angry. But he's not angry. He's extraordinary. And his sisters would say this about Paddy, that he's just very, there's an innocence and a beauty in the man, which is intriguing. And it's really gorgeous.
And I guess that, as a character, know that he's a real person, obviously, Donatello, but that's, as a character, that's very interesting to have somebody who's gone through such dark, challenging, you know, really violent actions done to him in his life, and yet to maintain that brightness in underneath it.
Well, that's a joy. You wouldn't want it to be all dark. So when you see the humour coming out and the audience reacting and really responding to the Belfast wit and the Belfast black humour, as somebody called it, you know, it's wonderful because he is that. He's a funny, charismatic man, and I'm... So far, we've been delighted with the way people have been responding to it. So long may it continue.
Yeah, and briefly, he did have one of the Cray brothers jumping to his defence in prison.
He did, Reggie Cray.
Reggie.
Not sure where, yeah, well, what did he do that made life a little bit easier for Paddy Armstrong?
Well, it's briefly mentioned. Listen, I suppose... everybody, kind of Reggie and those, they probably spoke to him. He would have been... people knew in prison that he was an innocent man. Reggie and a lot of the people would have recognised that.
They realised. It took a little while, but they started to realise there's no way this guy did this. He wouldn't be capable of it. And people, there were people who really looked after him in prison. And there's lovely friendships that you see. You know, people who were actually convicted, you know, bombers, but looking after him.
Yeah, and also Alistair Logan, we should mention, who not only, you know, got the conviction quashed, but looked after him. And at great personal cost to him,
yes,
Alistair Logan,
indeed,
he looked after him when he came out of prison and got things going. And Caroline, the now wife.
Wonderful now wife, absolutely.
Well, listen, thank you so much to both of you for coming into us.
So we'll be heading out on tour in Yeah, in January. So we start in the pavilions in Dunleary the 14th and 15th of January, and then we kind of start going around the country. We're in Galway and Limerick at the end of January. We're in Blackwater.
The Blackwater fit up down with my wonderful old buddy Jeff Gould there.
Yeah. And then we're in Donegal and we're in the Civic. And we've got a website.
lifeandtimesofpaddy.com.
Yeah, lifeandtimesofpaddy.com. Yeah, all of the dates are there, and we keep adding them. And there's a nice little trailer for the play if you want to see a little bit.
All right.
If you haven't heard enough already.
Mary, Tynan, Mary, your name is going on right out of my mind. Elaine Mary Tynan. Mary Elaine Tynan. I'll get it eventually.
I'm just going to let you hang yourself there.
Yeah, Tynan, Elaine, Mary, in
just,
some
just
order.
Just Donald do for me.
and Don Witcherly, who I know for a long time. I can remember his name. Yeah. The Life and Times of Paddy Armstrong will be touring Ireland from January, as we were told there. And you can find out full information on the website, lifeandtimesofpaddy.com. Thank you, Don Witcherly. And thank you, Mary Elaine Tynan.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The phrase greatest actor of his generation certainly gets bandied about a lot in Hollywood, but in the case of the man we're about to focus on now, that definition could perhaps be expanded to say the greatest actor of several generations. From his start on the medical drama St. Elsewhere to his most recent global cinema hit in Gladiator 2, Denzel Washington has brought an intensity, a charisma and an intelligence to all of his roles, often elevating fairly average films into something more than the sum of their parts. He has been rewarded handsomely by his peers with 9 Oscar nominations, 2 wins, and his awards haul is expected to grow significantly in the coming months. It is hard to believe, but Denzel Washington turns 70 at the end of this month, 20th of December.
That's right, 28th of December, 1954. He was born Denzel Jr., actually. His father was Denzel as well.
Let's say who's talking.
Oh, sorry, Sean, I was getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, let them know who this man who knows all about Denzel Jr. Washington is. It is John McGuire, of course, who's regularly with us talking about films. So go, John.
His father, Denzel Sr., was a Pentecostal minister, one of those firebrand guys who also worked for New York's public water company. His mother, Lenny, owned a beauty parlor in Mount Vernon, New York, in the suburbs outside the city. And they divorced when he was 14. Denzel was a bit of a tearaway, so he was sent to a private school, a military academy. And now there's no mention.
I was just going to say, where's
the acting?
He was doing nothing on the school play.
Exactly. He was doing nothing in the school play. There's no mention of amateur dramatics, acting classes, nothing like that. He was into basketball. And he went to Fordham University on a basketball scholarship.
So he was a good sportsman.
Journalism. Yeah. He was a proper college basketball player, yeah. So he went to this university in New York, Fordham University, an established university, to study journalism on a good course. Halfway through, somebody said, you should come out, do a minor in drama. So he went to the drama class, and the next thing you know, somebody, one of his tutors on graduation, recommended that he go to the American Conservatory Theatre in San Francisco, where he spent a year in his early 20s and became an actor in 12 months. Went back to New York, started the round of Broadway, off-Broadway auditions, all that kind of stuff. In 1981, in one of his very first performances, he won an Obie Award, which is for off-Broadway productions in New York, for a production of A Soldier's Play. That was 1981. That same year, he made his film debut opposite the comedian George Segal in a comedy called Carbon Copy, which nobody really remembers anymore. But this is a guy in his early 20s in New York, under his belt, Obie under his belt, and he's off to the races.
And not coming from any kind of theatrical
or stage
background.
5 years previous, he wanted to be a basketball journalist. Yeah. He wanted to be a sports writer. And the next thing you know, there he is. Because he's a handsome fella and he's full of charisma. Charisma coming out of his eyeballs. Yeah. He's a handsome guy, but he has this kind of regal authority that allows him to play an enormous range of characters. Yeah. We're not going to get through all of it, Sean, but we'll get through quite a few of them.
We're talking about 35 films or something like that.
Nearly 70 films.
For heaven's sake.
70 films. But you were mentioning St. Elsewhere. That's where I remember Denzel Washington from.
This was
one of the greatest television series of all time, probably the greatest medical drama ever produced, 1982 to 1988. He was one of the very few African-American actors to appear on screen at all on television in America at the time. He played throughout the entire run, for the entire 6-year run, one of the very few cast members.
And what was the nature of that, if you can remember, what was the nature of that character? Was he a charismatic?
Dr. Philip Chandler was a surgeon, I believe. Or maybe he was kind of a war doctor. Yes, charisma. Yes, handsome. Yes, lots of romantic, as far as I can recall, lots of kind of romantic subplots the whole way through.
Yeah.
But, you know, he got his start and he took his start. He took advantage very early on, and there was kind of no way back after that. He's been a star since the early 1980s.
He seems to have known from the very start, from you describe it there, just how to choose the right things and how to.
I was just about to say, at the time he could have played, as a black actor, he would have been playing supporting roles. He didn't go down that route. He started to play the lead, and one of his first leads was in Cry Freedom. Richard Attenborough's.
Where he was playing Steve Biko in this, wasn't
played
he?
Steve Biko, the human rights activist who was murdered by the South African police authorities. And he was playing opposite Kevin Kline in Cry Freedom, and he received his first Oscar nomination for that.
I think that's where I best first supporting saw him, actor. And he just was so striking.
Exactly. It was that power and authority that Washington has put through all of these performances, right up to Gladiator, right now in Gladiator. He's never lost it. He lost out on the night to Sean Connery, but he was back 2 years later and he won Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of an ex-slave soldier in the first all-black volunteer company in the Union Army in the Civil War in Glory, opposite Morgan Freeman and Matthew Broderick. Heavyweight actors, huge action sequences, a lot of drama. Edward Zick had written this really dense historical drama and he sailed through it. He was absolutely magnetic in that. It's a super film.
It's one of the things he seems to have, when you think of so many films, is just that ease. You talk about him sailing through it. He makes it look as if he's doing nothing, which is the great skill of the screen actor, isn't it?
That's it, absolutely. And his command of the camera as well is exceptional. He really knows how to communicate emotion without reams and reams of dialogue. And if we when we look through now, his first major collaboration, Sean, I suppose, is with Spike Lee.
Yeah, Spike Lee has been one of the major filmmakers or collaborative parties in his life.
Spike glommed onto Denzel Starr really early on.
I suppose Denzel Washington was made to play Malcolm X.
Exactly. And Spike Lee at that time would have been looking around for black actors to star in black stories. And there wasn't as many as you might expect, and certainly not as many as we have today. Mo Better Blues was the start of it. Malcolm X, He Got Game, and Inside Man is more recently, and they're working on a new film together. But it's the Malcolm X, the Spike Lee's biopic of the civil rights leader. Again, another civil rights leader, was his first real collaboration. By the time it arrived in 1992, controversy, protests, but in the end, there's no arguing about Washington's powerhouse central performance. It's less a picture of one man than as three or four men, because he goes right the way through the story.
Yeah, because Malcolm X's evolution. It's a huge character arc.
And enormously important to the black people in America, the African-American community. And this story is absolutely vital to them. And Spike was very careful in how he portrayed it. But Washington was much less careful. He gave it everything.
Warts that had to be shown?
Well, there was. I mean, you're going from being a petty thief as a teenager to becoming essentially a spiritual leader. And he was nominated, Al Pacino won on the night again, to widespread disbelief, really. Even Spike Lee said at the time, his quote on the night was, "I'm not the only one who thinks Denzel was robbed tonight," what he said. And he was right. People thought, that there was absolutely no comparison. Al Pacino, I think, won for Scent of a Woman or one of those kind of films.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip.
From Malcolm X.
This is Denzel Washington as Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was hugely charismatic. Malcolm X had extraordinary oratorical skills. And just listen to how Denzel Washington can echo both of those qualities and more besides.
"Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an Elk, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Jew or a Christian, we were black people. In fact, before there was any such place as America, we were black. And after America has long passed from the scene, there will still be black people. I'm going to tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify. They're sent here and set up here by the white men. This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking."
There you go. And we're just talking with John McGuire there. That's Denzel Washington as Malcolm X in Spike Lee's film of the same name. It is, that is just, even you just listen to that minute and 4 seconds of, I mean, it's amazing speech, to be fair. You just wonder, how on earth did Denzel Washington not win the Best Actor Oscar?
Well, you'd have
Oscar?
To say that a lot of the reason why he was making these films in the first place was reflected back at him in the reception that he found from within the industry and from the wider audience as well. And some of the films that he made at the time certainly had themes of racial injustice and racial oppression, and America just wasn't ready for that conversation. You'd even argue that they're not ready for it still. But Lee and Washington are currently in post-production on a film called Highest to Lowest, that's the number two, which will be their fifth film together. Now, this is unfortunately a reimagining of an Akira Kurosawa 1963 crime drama, High and Low, which is a classic film. And so I don't know how I feel about that. Spike Lee has mixed back history with adaptations and reimaginings and remakes. So I'm not sure how I feel about that, but it is kind of amazing that 40 odd years later that they're still working together, that they still see something in one another. And Spike Lee has cast John David Washington, who's Denzel's son, in Black Klansman, for instance. He was superb in that film. Probably because his father was a bit too old to play the part, but you know, there might have been a bit of competition there as well.
Well, he's pretty good himself.
But he's pretty good himself.
Imagine carrying that. I mean, I've been saying I was listening.
That was his debut role as well, his debut on film.
Yeah, you know how difficult it must be to be in any scene, anywhere near a scene with Denzel Washington, because he's got such magnetism,
such power,
on the screen. We mentioned Spike Lee. Obviously, another important set of collaborations, if you like, are the two Scots, Tony and Ridley.
Yeah. Tony Scott, the late Tony Scott, they made five films together. This isn't the same level of film. Yeah. This is commercial cinema. Tony Scott was a Hollywood filmmaker who was making studio films, predominantly flashy crime dramas. So this is a totally different aspect to it. But it didn't start like that. They made a submarine war movie together, Crimson Tide, Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman even then had a reputation of being just way streets ahead of everybody else. And that was in 1995. He was a relatively young actor and he more than held his own. There's a big long break then of 10 years or so when they started making these, how would you classify them really? None of them are classics exactly. Yeah. Man on Fire, Deja Vu, a remake of The Taken of Pelham 1, 2, 3, and a movie called Unstoppable. But this was Washington reinventing himself as a middle-aged action hero in the Liam Neeson mode, I suppose. And they worked and they all made a huge amount of money.
Big box office.
And no doubt that they would have collaborated on more, but Tony Scott died in 2012 and it's... Ridley Scott then picked up the baton, and given his close relationship with his brother, it's odd that it took him until 2007 to cast him in American Gangster, which is this deeply cynical real life true crime drama about a drug lord who ships his heroine in from the Far East in the coffins of returning American GIs. And Washington is firing on all cylinders here. He gives an unbelievable performance. It's not a brilliant film, but he is brilliant in it.
However, a brilliant film, and I think he is brilliant in it. You believe both of Training Day.
Yeah, Training Day is one of my personal favourites, yeah.
Explain the role he's playing here, because it's interesting given the charisma and all of that was what he had to do.
He doesn't play a lot of villains, but when he does, he's, as he did for Ridley Scott in Gladiator 2, which is arch-villainry, this is a little slipperier and a little more difficult. He's playing a character called Alonzo Harris, who's a police detective in Los Angeles. It's probably the most extreme example, I suppose, of that kind of villainy. Within the first couple of minutes of this thriller directed by Antoine Fuqua, he's forced his rookie, who's on his first day on the job,
Ethan Hawke,
to smoke weed at gunpoint. And then we discovered that the weed had actually been laced with angel dust. So this is not a good guy. This is right from the start. We understand that this is not a good guy. And over the 24 hours that the film takes place over that training day, the pair investigate drug gangs and police corruption while Alonzo schemes to save his neck and to adjust these events.
We listened to him in Malcolm X and we heard how he could hold the screen and our ears for a minute and 4 seconds. Here's another clip about the same duration, ironically enough. You'll hear very little from Denzel Washington's character Alonzo, but here's a lesson in how to let some other actor do all the work and then just doof in at the very end of the scene and steal it.
It's pretty good.
Okay, pretty good, Debbie. Mid-watch, go.
Right. All right. Well, so it was a real quiet night.
Boom!
You never know. That's the point. Go.
All right. Well, it was quiet night. We're rolling on Van Owen. I'm driving. This Acura, just a beautiful car, comes out of side street, all over the median, in excess. I light it up, hit the whaler. Guy drives on like I'm invisible for 10 blocks before he pulls over. All right, plates run clean, and so I field test and arrest, and I'm belting him in our unit, and Debbie's tossing his car. She calls me over to the vehicle and shows me a snub 38 and two shotguns fully loaded and locked.
No shit.
No shit. So she calls our supervisor, and I keep searching. I find 500 grams of meth in the dash. Turns out this DUI is on bail for distribution. He's on his way to smoke his ex-partner before trial.
Boom.
We prevented a murder.
You got him. It's amazing. It is. That you could be out there with a fine bitch for a year, and the most entertaining story that you can come up with to tell me is a drunk stop.
Yeah. Because I should have said before, he had said to Ethan Hawke, you got to tell me your funniest story.
Yeah,
so he lets him patter away there for the majority of that.
He cuts
and then
him
just,
down,
you know, shoots. But that tells you, I suppose, something of the nature of the
He's having
the
a
actor.
Lot of fun here, I
yeah.
think.
Denzel Washington, we're celebrating his career. He's 70 on the 28th of December. John McGuire with me in studio this evening. There's a big theatre background here
oh, yeah.
as well. And,
yeah, yeah.
and
Broadway star, Denzel Washington, Broadway star. He's had a number of massive successes on Broadway, but you want to talk about the tragedy of Macbeth.
Yeah,
I love this film. I think it's one of his very best films.
Quite recent, isn't it? Actually,
quite recent. 2022. It's a bit of an outlier. He hadn't done a lot of Shakespeare on screen. He was in Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing, but that was more of a romantic lead. Here he's Imperious as Macbeth, opposite Frances McDormand's Lady Macbeth. This very stylish, text-focused adaptation. There's a tightness to him in this film. There's a kind of an athleticism to him and a laser focus, and he strips the character right down to his essentials, and that's support.
And it's in black. It's
in black and white. It's monochrome on these kind of stylized, kind of
almost
expressionisty kind of sets. Yeah, but and it's the one thing that you'll see throughout Washington's career is that he surrounds himself with other brilliant actors.
Yeah, and he certainly does.
Extraordinary cast.
Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth,
and he's really good at that, bouncing off other talents. He's really exceptional.
Catherine Hunter plays
the
witches.
Yeah.
Not one of them, all of them, all three of them.
She's a brilliant actor too.
Yeah, and here is a little interaction between the aforementioned Denzel as Macbeth and Catherine Hunter as the witches.
But what is this? And rises like the issue of a king and wears upon his baby brow the round and top of sovereignty.
Listen, but speak not to it.
Macbeth shall never vanquish me. Great Burnham Wood, to hide Dunsinane Hill, shall come against him.
That will never be. Who can impress the forest? Bid the tree unfix his earth-brown root, yet my heart throbs to know one thing more. Tell me, if your heart can tell so much. Shall Banquo's issue ever reign in this kingdom?
Seek to know no more. Seek to know. No more.
Oh, I'd leave it be if I were you, Macbeth. I wouldn't go looking to find anything else out, but of course he doesn't. He can't leave it alone. That's Denzel Washington in The Tragedy of Macbeth with the Coen brothers, and Catherine Hunter was the other voice, an actor that you heard in the midst of that. John McGuire, as we say, happy 70th birthday to Denzel Washington on the 20th. How would you sum up has he done much comedy, actually? I meant to ask
no,
you that.
No, not a huge amount of comedy, and for the last 20-odd years or so, very little what you might call romantic lead kind of stuff as well. Not an awful lot of heroes either. He's an actor of immense natural charm, and he's combined that with the ability to play really high, really noble, really regal kind of characters, and also the kind of street level game players, that kind of smirking, cunning thing that he does as well. But he reeks of intelligence, Sean. That's what he's just a very smart guy. And I think audiences love that about him. The sense of authority that he brings to a role is an extension of that. And he can be very smooth, very compelling, an easy charm. He's got this fighting spirit, and you want to follow him. You want to root for him, regardless of who's, even if it's in junk like The Equalizer, which he's going to make two more of, apparently. You just follow him in what he's doing. And he's occasionally so big and powerful that he's just magnetic.
And of course, I heard Paul Mescal on Graham Norton speaking about, you know, how nervous he was about being on screen.
I'd say he would intimidate a younger actor very easily.
But he didn't seem to do that. He seemed to be very keen to praise
Paul Mescal, all that kind of stuff. That, yeah, but know, then but when you're there on the day, it's probably a different story. But if you were talking at the start, Sean, about the greatest American actors working today, he's certainly one of the contenders. There's very few peers. If you look around in the way that the film industry has changed over the course of Washington's career, these aren't the kind of actors. Denzel Washington are not the kind of actors that we make anymore. And unlike other maturing leading men, he has no trouble transitioning out of one role and into another. And that's what makes him different.
That's what makes him different. That is John McGuire speaking to us about Denzel Washington, who will be 70 on the 28th of December. Sean Fitzgerald is a man of many talents, a ballad singing tour guide, a musician and a passionate advocate for preserving Dublin's folk traditions. Whether he's leading a group through the streets of London, sharing forgotten ballads that tell stories of everyday life, or performing with his band, the Deadlians, Sean's work bridges the gap between history and music. Last night, he was on stage with the Pogues at the Three Arena, delivering a rousing rendition of Mush and Durkin, but I'm delighted he's with me in the studio now. And you're going to perform a song called Alexander the Great, and you were about to tell me a little bit about it. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about it before you perform it, Sean?
Okay, so this is from a book of Psalms called the Celtic Psalter. And it was written by, or it was translated by Alfred Percival Graves, who's Robert Graves' father, author of Goodbye to All That and I, Claudius and everything like this. And he translated some great stuff by Ferguson and like a lot of very old Irish poets, and I did one album, but I transcribed or put melodies to the poetry of Seamus O'Kelly, the kind of bard at Loch Ree, and he wrote The Weaver's Grave, and we put all his poetry to music, and so just the kind of the level of language is
this your own melody that we're going to hear in Alexander?
Yeah, I put the melody to this. It's from the 9th century, sometime around there.
Right, Alexander the Great.
Four sages stood to chant the stave above the proud earth's conqueror's grave, and all their words were words of candor above the urn of Alexander. The first began but yesterday, when all in state the great king lay, myriads around made moan, today he lieth all alone. For yesterday the second sang, all earth is charger if it rang, today it's outraged soil instead, tis riding heavy o'er his head. For yesterday the third went on, all earth was swayed by Philip's son, today to shroud his calcined bones, 7 feet are all he owns. For yesterday so liberally, the silver gold he scattered free, today the last outside his thought, his wealth abounds but he is not. Thus sentence gave the sages four, above the buried emperor, oh, it's no foolish man's pride that held him so in high debate.
John Fitzgerald there with his song Alexander the Great. I'm going to say with the words by Robert Graves' father, but remind me of Robert,
Alfred Percival Graves.
Alfred Percival Graves, the text that Sean was singing for us there. You've spoken, Sean, I think, about the idea of two places in Dublin that are a real gateway to the past for you.
Yeah.
Marsh's Library and St. Patrick's Cathedral. Tell me about Marsh's Library, first of all, because it's an interesting little book that you have in front of you there.
Yeah, now, Marsh's Library, I love Marsh's Library. I wouldn't know like a tremendous amount about it, but I do love old places like that. And just like, I think, you know, when you're in the present, you have a vision of reality. You know, you're kind of, you know, you've got this context and you're kind of blind to
the past.
The past. Yeah. And we in the 20th century, we make a great song and dance and put people on pedestals for their great works of writing. And then you look in these books and you find these amazing poems.
It's been there before.
And they're anonymous. And you go, well, who was this dude? Like, you know, it's been happening hundreds of times, thousands of times.
And I guess that's part of, you do this this ballad tour of Dublin.
Yeah.
So it's not just that you walk around singing songs that are attached to certain streets. I think there's more about you're trying to open up the past through music. Is that what's
I'm
involved?
Trying to, there's things you can sing that you can't say. So I work with Original Dublin. They're a very good tour company and they're very good at like the organisational kind of, you know, they're just
the nuts and bolts of it.
Nuts and bolts.
You like doing the artistic side.
Yeah, and they're very good on their history. You know what I mean? They know what's going on, you know, what went on. And I'd be reasonably good at history as well, but I like a bit of folklore as well. I do a bit of folklore, a bit of history, and then different songs connected them. So St. Patrick's Cathedral I love because of its connection with this work called The Diaboloid, written by William Kuhn. And it's a kind of a mad folkloric tale where the devil doesn't want to be the devil anymore and he's crying and a necromancer says to him, well, you know, what nation in Christendom sends most souls to hell? And the devil goes, why Ireland? Where all men rob each other and make no restitution. And the wizard friend of the devil says, well, you must go there and you know, find out what you can find out. And he goes and he finds Simon Luttrell, the notorious sheriff of hell. And beneath Dublin's Christchurch, there was dens of iniquity and casinos and everything going on in the catacombs. And that's an amazing kind of thing, you know.
And the album that I have in front of me here is The Deadlians Rid the Land of the Greedy Toads. You're launching it tomorrow night yourself?
Yeah,
and
we're
the band?
Launching the vinyl tomorrow night with Trad Rave, who is my favourite DJ. You know, I wouldn't be. I don't know much about the DJing world, but he's pretty.
He does it for
excellent.
You.
Yeah,
you have a second song which has a particularly seasonal feel to it.
Yeah, The Kings Who Came to Christ, another old Irish 9th century song, and I just think it really paints some beautiful imagery, and you can imagine the three kings chasing this star through the deserts, and you know, it's real fairy tale.
Well,
stuff.
Let's have a listen, Sean Fitzgerald and the Three Wise Kings.
Thanks.
Three kings came to the babe's abode with faces like the bright moon gold. From out the Lord eastern world, where o'er the white deserts curled, three sought out the lovely child on whom the white blossom battle smiled. Three kings o'er knowledge granted sway, 3 shares of the vision day, the promise of the great all-wise was present in his prescient eyes. A vision beckoning from afar, the Christ child cradled on a star, a lofty star of loosened ray. It swam before them through the day, and when our hues were lost in night, it still led on in love and light. And still the lucky royal tree went following it readily, and still across the firmament an arch of blessed might it went. So rushing, radiant, round and soft, past every star it paced aloft. Right joyously it stayed for him. It's still at last o'er blessed Bethlehem. And each monarch of the tree with worship fell upon the knee and gave while God he loud extolled frankincense and myrrh and gold. They recognized the babe's bright face and Mary in her virgin grace. Was thus the star epiphany showed Christ their king to the kings. Three.
Beautiful stuff indeed. The Three Wise Kings from Sean Fitzgerald. And you can see and hear Sean with his band, The Deadlians, and their Violin album launch at the Christmas party with Trad Rave tomorrow night at the Grand Social, thegrandsocial.ie for full details on that. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound. Leah Murphy researched. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.